Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday, April 4th, in the magic year of 2014. This is Jeff Dunphy coming to you from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. We are today reviewing and working on retooling for our coming of age. And every now and again, we do an oversight or a macro explanation of a bunch of things that are happening. And today we're going to review water in the world, economic calamity, and political calamity, which oftentimes go hand in hand, and possibly even war. Whoa, there's some big stuff today. Now, I have been working with a variety of students over the last several years, and we chat about the evolution of the planet. And one of the things that is often brought up and often brought to tabled is the concept that the Earth itself is changing. Now, one of the laws that is a cosmic law that has been handed down to us by the ancients, but is pretty obvious if you have the inclination to see, is called the law of correspondence, which goes as above, so below, and as below, so above. So when we see things changing on the planet, it is fair to say that things are changing on the constituents of the planet, in the atmosphere, on the ground, on the earth, inside the mantle of the earth, in the oceans, in the ice caps. And if, in fact, Mother Earth is changing, it cannot help but be that all the inhabitants of Mother Earth are changing. And it also, from a even more esoteric perspective, the aspect of what is floating around in the ethers, if you will, is changing. So, where do we go with this? Well, let's first ponder a couple of things that have been incredibly in the public's mind of late. And let's chat a little about climate change. Now, one of my great teachers years and years ago was talking about climate change. And one of the things that she posited at the time was, isn't it a bit egotistical of mankind to think that mankind could have such a deleterious effect on the environment, so much so that the Earth itself would change? I think her point being made was, were we instrumentally and only involved in the climate change that the world was experiencing, and the message was received loudly and clearly, no, mankind is not the only issue going on relative to Earth changes. Now, it doesn't mean that we are not facilitating or speeding them up or contributing to the denigration of the planet. I'm not suggesting that for a moment, but certainly what has transpired over time, over the last 15 or 20 years in terms of our awareness of it, has been a long time coming, and our appreciation of how we can help in mitigating this these changes is called for. Mankind contributes to the decline of the Earth and to these Earth changes, but it is very naive to think that mankind is the sole is solely responsible for these. So now I'm going to share with you a program that I saw on National Geographic with a guy named, I think it was James Balog, and he's done some lovely work on the water and the ice on the planet. Now, he was given the mandate to go out and do a review of the glaciers in the Northern Hemisphere. So he went to Alaska, and he went to various parts of Baffin Island, he went to various parts around, and Greenland was when I sort of plugged into this program. And he has since created a film and a documentary that he has been chatting about throughout North America, I believe, and maybe even in Europe. His name is James Balog. Now, I'll tell you the germane aspects of this, because it was quite an interesting expose on Greenland itself and what was happening. So in the program, a bunch of his scientists, his geoscientists, are setting up camp on the glacier that sits on top of Greenland. Now, at some places, this glacier is 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 kilometers deep, And certainly on the fringes, it's less deep, but they are there in the summertime when the sun is on the glacier much of the day. And consequently, the glacier was experiencing the equivalent of great big melts. So these melts were 5, 6, 8, 10 feet deep. So they'd have these big lakes, and the lakes would be maybe a kilometer across and a couple kilometers. You know, they wouldn't be huge lakes, but they would be all over Greenland. And so his crew was set up, and they set up lasers, and they set up surveying equipment so they could see where the glacier was, and if in fact it was retracting, if it was moving, how it was doing these things. And the task was for them to start measuring them. And so they'd set up 1, 2, 5, 10, 20, 50 cameras, and they'd start to take pictures, time-lapse photography of these pictures. And they started to, in the process of this, they'd come back year after year, and it was, you know, the bottom line is the glacier is on Greenland is receding quite rigorously, and it would appear on the west side of Greenland, more so than on the east side of Greenland. Now, during one of their shoots and during one of their things, they were watching the glacier calve. Now, calving is when an aspect of the glacier, this continent of ice, if you will, their calving is when great slabs of it just fall off into the water. And so they were filming this at the time, and they showed some calving of the glacier and how it was falling into the ocean. And these were not inconsequential aspects of calving. I mean, you'd have great chunks of ice that would be 200 feet high, 300 feet high. So, you know, 20 or 30 stories high. And so you'd be seeing the equivalent of these buildings fall into the ocean. So they'd be 20 or 30, 40 feet high and maybe 100 feet across. So these were not inconsequential calves. So further on in the program, as you continue to watch, they were setting up their equipment and their thing, and they heard this just almighty crack and boom, and they watched a calve off the Greenland ice glacier that was the size of Manhattan Island. And so consequently, they did a comparison, and they showed that all of Manhattan just slid into the equivalent of an iceberg the size of Manhattan slid into the ocean. And it was quite a remarkable expose on what's happening to these glaciers everywhere in the world. And we're now getting information that Antarctica is starting to experience melts as well. So further into the program, or in the program as well, they would be camped next to these big lakes, modestly big lakes, if you will, and they would hear big cracks and rumbles, and it sounded like thunder, and the thunder was the calving of these things into the ocean. But what they were also experiencing was cracks in the glacier underneath the lakes. Now, when a lake built in ice in an ice cube cracks, we've heard and seen ice in our drinks crack. So what they did is they grabbed their ropes and they put their cleats on, their hiking boots, and they went to see where the water was going. Now, I'm not sure if all scientists thought this, but it's my understanding that the geoscientists of yesterday thought that when an ice glacier, when an iceberg or a glacier cracked and a pool of water melted into it, that it just melted, or it the water flowed down into it, and then it just adhered to the side of the glacier as it fell through the glacier itself. And that is in fact what they suggested. They said, we always thought that the water just froze 100 or 200 or 500 feet further down. However, what they witnessed during this show, or during this expose, what they witnessed wasn't that at all. What they witnessed was that these craters, these cracks in the glacier, that the lakes were melting into, and they were watching all this water rush down, the water doesn't adhere to the side of the glacier at all and refreeze. It flows right to the ground, right to the granite that Greenland is based on, the actual earth itself. So In some instances, on some of these lakes, the water was flowing down to the ground 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers deep. Now, this has strange implications. It has implications because what definitely presents itself is that the scientists of yesterday thought that these glaciers would take 500 years to melt. And at this program, when I saw, the guy said, well, we used to think, with recent discoveries, we think it's 50 years. And then all of a sudden, all this stuff happens. And he just says, I don't know. We don't know how long this is going to take to melt. Now, I want to introduce a concept, another one of those magic cosmic laws called the law of acceleration. And the law of acceleration happens in various times, in time epochs or epochs, in the evolution of the Earth, the evolution of mankind, and the evolution of the solar system, the evolution of the cosmos, if you will, if we want to take a Carl Sagan phrase. And the law of acceleration says as certain things start to happen, the happening of the certain things start to speed up. So all of a sudden, it expresses itself in these scientists said, these will take 500 years to melt. Oops, maybe 50. Whoops, now we don't even know. And it speaks to a place that not a whole lot of people want to hear about because it's a bit unsettling, and that is, it would appear as if Greenland is melting. Well, that's a given. Everybody goes, okay, yeah, it's melting. But the scientists are saying, yeah, 50 or 100 years. And everybody's going, okay, 50 or 100 years, we have to deal with something. Well, the ice on Greenland alone, and this is important, the ice on Greenland alone, if it just fell into the ocean, not if it even melted, because if it falls into the ocean, it displaces the water. But the ice on Greenland alone would add 7 meters to the ocean's the sea level. So 7 meters is 22 feet. And 22 feet would flood and destroy 80 of the largest 100 cities on the planet. Now, that's not inconsequential. It's also something that a lot of people will go, yeah, that's just conspiracy theory or whatever it is, whatever the phrase is. Well, that's just catastrophizing something. However, let's now go back to what we oftentimes base some of our insight into, and that would be the ancient teachings. Now, the ancient teachings, and certainly some of the things that have come to us in the last 150 years, there was a great series of letters written between some very wise sages, Kuthumi and Moria, in the late 1800s to a guy named Alfred Sinnett. Now, Alfred Sinnett was a very smart, very wise Brit. He was in London. And he developed a relationship and a rapport with these individuals, masters called Moria and Kuthumi. And they started a correspondence. And the correspondence constituted 160 or 180 letters. Now, these letters are still housed in the British Library. And so one of the last 2 times ago when I was in London, I went and actually read them, went and flipped through them rather than read all the way through them. I flipped through them because they are voluminous and you can't sit down and read 169 letters at a single sitting. But I felt them and saw them as they were written in longhand, clearly. And there were some very magic things, and perhaps we will cover and speak of the Mahatma letters at a different time. But the more important and germane thing about the Mahatma letters at this point in time was that Sinnett posited the question to one of these great sages and said, what's going to happen? What about earth changes? And the response to that was, we will see massive water coming in during the first front end of the 21st century. Now, how is it that they can tell? Well, I would posit also that we have seen these sages throughout time, and they have come in and they've been extraordinarily wise and extraordinarily plugged in to realms that we don't yet even know exist. And those who search for the way or search for this place of genius, as we speak to in the engineering school, they plug into their genius. Well, they've plugged into their genius in such a fashion that they have the capacity to see things as they unfold. So this was given us 150 years ago, that a whole bunch of water events would be happening. Now, if we remember correctly, I think, some time ago, there was mention of a whole bunch of water events happening in Britain, where the British town folk were getting together in certain parts of Britain. This would be the southwest corner of Britain. They were getting together and they were saying, well, we can save the towns or we can save the countryside, which is it or we're going to do because we only have limited resources. The economic, but more importantly, the geological, the geographic calamity that has been a result of some of these storms that have been hitting England this year is quite shocking. And I would beg that you go and review England and Britain's storms, because there's no question that it has unbelievable implications relative to where things are going with this water. Now we talk about storms, okay? And we talk about the storms of this winter in England and the weather getting unbelievably wild. And we also made reference in previous shows to how the insurance companies have been paying out more and more and more and more for the last 20 or 30 years. We talked about from 1980 to 1923, how expansions of floods and storms. Now, we saw a Hurricane Sandy came in and absolutely devastated the east coast of the U.S. around New York. It was one of those, a huge tidal surge, a storm that was absolutely mind-bogglingly big. It wiped out areas, very broad areas of New Jersey. They're still repairing them now. So it's interesting, or not so much interesting, but prophetic perhaps, that these masters would years ago say that the earth is going to experience some pretty big water events. Now, in the concept or in the context of these water events, let's chat a little about just Greenland melting and what 7 meters of water does to the planet. Now, if you know that 7 meters of water is coming, you start to make plans now. And one of the things that I've seen in terms of the Discovery Network or some of the channels on the web is that there are engineering projects underway to design a methodology to withstand big damaging floods by building effectively a great dam around some of these cities. Well, if they knew that was going to happen, then they might take action to see that they could prevent the calamity that would be as a result of a 7 meter rise in the ocean level. Now, that being said, what does tend to happen in these things is that everybody sits down and some people say, well, I think the ocean level is going to rise by a big amount, perhaps 7 meters, just if Greenland melts. And somebody says, you're nuts. It'll be 7 feet in the next several hundred years. And there becomes a debate as to the legitimacy of this declaration. Now, some of us have taken the time and effort to actually do the math and look at some of the ice on the planet. And some of us have plugged into the observation, which is very valid. There's no dispute as to magnetic north and true north. The discrepancy between the two is becoming greater and greater and greater. And for those of you who are navigators, you know this. You know that as you sail, you have to set your compass differently to accommodate the difference between true north and magnetic north. And this number gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it is moving. If you are looking at the planet from outer space, if you're looking at the planet and you see the North Pole is on the top, it's moving to the left. If you were facing England, it is the magnetic North Pole is moving to the left. So weather changes are coming, heat on one side and cool on the other, which is in alignment with what the scientists would say. Now, if you take into account and do some of the math on some of the other ice formations on the planet, the quick math tells us that perhaps 7 meters may not be the number. Perhaps
it could go as high as 50 or 60 meters. Now, if that happens, you're going to see geological changes, the likes of which have not been contemplated in this latest iteration of what we think of as our history. So our history, we've been told sociologically that our history is 5,000 years old. We haven't seen these kind of earth changes in 5,000 years. And perhaps the last kind of earth change that happened was about 15,000 years ago. For those of you who believe the earth is more than 5,000 years old, and civilization is as well. So now, what does that mean? Well, it means the dawning of a new age. It means the shifting and the changing of Mother Earth. And it means the advent of the Aquarian Age in a very magic way. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think flooding of the earth is going to be particularly well received, and it will result in the loss of massive amounts of the population. I mean, the population of the earth will change if you see floods like this. Oh, we have seen a flood like this many years ago. This was in the time of Noah. It is not outside of the realm of the Earth's history to have floods. It's food for thought. It's something that we might want to pay attention to, and it's something that the ancients know of, knew of, and wrote of. And it's something that, for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, we might be well served to listen to the harbinger of things to come. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that many of the cities will go underwater, and I suspect with the way that mankind is working now, and that is how to make the best buck on the calamities that's approaching, as opposed to take care of and tend to your fellow citizens, there may be some financial profiteering going on in order to facilitate helping these people. Again, forgive my cynicism, however, in the very same breath, it's a cynicism well-founded with the actions and activities of mankind. So just as we've seen all these storms going down in Britain, and just as the James Balog of the world have shown us that we're seeing all these ice formations melt quite rigorously, the inevitability of the rise of the surface of the ocean, the sea level, is upon us. And it's something that we need to pay attention to. Okay, so now we're going to step into, if things are changing on Mother Earth, things will change on Mother Earth's inhabitants and how people govern and rule and play with the planet. So now we're going to move in, segue into economy, the economic and the capacity of the world's economy to play, and how it has manifested and unfolded. Now, for those of you who were actively involved in the business world from 1995 to 2007, give or take, when you were actively involved in that, it was a period astrologically where Pluto was in Sagittarius. Now, after 2007, there was a period where Pluto was in Capricorn. Now, let's chat a little about astrology, and I think it behooves us to suggest that astrology is not the nonsensical thing that you see in the horoscope, but it is something that from time immemorial has been unbelievably important to mankind. And I would also suggest that the likes of many a very famous scientist have been not only conversant in astrology, but instrumental in its use in terms of their own investigations and in their own scientific searches. So, for example, Sir Isaac Newton was once asked about astrology, and he said conventional society would have it that astrology is nonsense. However, I have studied it and proven otherwise. So consequently, let's not get too caught up in the meme of the day in thinking that astrology is horoscope. Astrology is unbelievably important. The planets are unbelievably important. And to think otherwise is contemporary amnesia, and it is also sociological naivete. Now let's chat a little about the moving of tendencies of the globe and where and what has transpired in that. And let's chat a little about, there's a guy named Manfred Zimmel who produces and works in and with astrology and the economics. And he is, he was gracious enough, although I'm not inconversant in astrology, he's gracious enough to put something into a chart that basically talks about the sentiment from 95 to 07 economically, financially, was one of happiness and hope and mania and optimism. And if some of you might remember, between 95 and 2000, this was the era that the internet started to explode. And also around the turn of the century, 2000 was the era when dot-coms started to do absolutely phenomenally ridiculous things. So the basic tendency was expansion and growth and abundance in this time frame. The symbolism was endowment of life with meaning, community, values, goal orientation, freedom, philosophy, religion. The economic business process and flow was free trade, globalization, free enterprise, dismantling trade barriers. Again, this was also the time of the explosion of the internet. The economic confidence and tendency to take risks was high. The role of the state was rather irrelevant. It was involved in capitalism as opposed to socialism, effectively. The stock markets were manic, and there was lots of overvaluation going on. And the political predisposition at the time were do-gooders, religious, philosophical topics dominated. And, you know, there was at this time, there was fundamentalist terror running around, but there was stuff happening. Now, as Pluto moved into Capricorn in 08, what did we see in 08? Well, we saw in 08 one of the greatest financial collapses ever, and we saw the Americans run in to save the banks that then became defined as too big to fail, which is the direct reaction to the development of, or the passing of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, and it was then that the bankers started to run the economy. And in that time, we had a couple of great collapses. We had a collapse just at the beginning of the First World War in 1914. We had a collapse in 1930-33 in there. And then we had a collapse in 1971 where we went off the gold standard. So all of these are indicators, milestones, if you will, of the challenges that were happening. So now in 2008, up until now, Pluto is in Capricorn. Well, here's the basic sentiment of Capricornians, and that is caution, fearful, defensive, pessimistic. The basic tendency is contraction and scarcity. The symbolism is discipline, perseverance, steadiness, order, concentration, hard nose, karma, laws, norms, controls, technology. The economic and the business predisposition, restriction of economic freedom, nationalizations, prices fixed by the state and not by the markets, centrally planned economy, re-erection of trade barriers. So now we're coming into this place where the astrology of this era speaks to what the governments are doing. And so now we play the macro. We see, well, maybe this astrology has some validity after all. Maybe it shows us and gives us a bit of a roadmap into understanding things in a bit bigger picture. Restriction of economic freedom, absolutely happening. Nationalizations, absolutely happening. Prices fixed by the state, well, guess what? Not only are we having class action lawsuits against the banks, which are now organized and work hand in hand with the state, we're having people sued because they say they are mucking in the free market. Wow, sound familiar? Sounds something like a broken record coming from me, doesn't it? The economic confidence and tendency to take risks right now, according to the Capricornian predisposition, is low. And the role of the state is now becoming more dominant, decisive, and planned in its economic manipulation. The stock markets, although pumped up by the inflation of the money printing, real values are low now. Now, and the political scenario right now is running amok in how the state controls the general population. We are giving up our freedoms. Certainly the Edward Snowden acts of the last little bit has created a scenario that gives us great pause when it comes to how the state is involved with, one, limiting our freedom, but two, doing it all under the guise of keeping us safe. It would appear that there are indications that the government is safeguarding themselves against what will happen when everybody does figure it out that they're only in it for themselves. Now, we talked earlier in earlier programs about extractive states and inclusive states. And extractive states, which I dare say is what we're in right now, is when all the politicos and all the economic powers that be are trying to pull as much out of the system as they can because they do see an imminent collapse of the system. We are in the middle of a collapse. However, the powers that be are so powerfully entrenched that they are doing everything they can to postpone this collapse. Now, we're going to talk about some financial issues. We're going to talk about another guy named James Rickert, who's done some work in Bosco and I months ago, maybe better part of a year ago, we reviewed his book Currency Wars, and he's also got a new book coming out called The Demise of Money or something to the like the death of money. Yeah, and it hasn't been released yet, but it's coming out soon. So relative to that, we have all of the economies and now the political capacity and the financial capacity. The banks and the politicians are now so firmly entrenched that one doesn't do, in fact, I think the politicians are told what to do by the money men, so unequivocally so that the scam of the ruse is now starting to haunt the politicians and the banks. So one of the things that comes to light in all of this in terms of macroeconomic stuff is that we will see the demise of certain currencies. And we are starting to see the demise of the American currency because they've printed so much paper at this point in time that it's their capacity to remain legitimate is fast approaching a Monty Python skit. How can you print infinite amounts of paper and expect that your paper is valuable? It also comes to light that the Americans owe hundreds of trillions of dollars and they only generate $3 trillion a year. So it's pretty, I mean, on anybody's balance sheets, they would be called bankrupt. Now, the next iteration on this is, where are those cultures that historically don't think in terms of quarters or 12 months? They think in terms of decades or centuries, and we have some long-sighted nations by nature, and the Chinese are such, the Asians are such. They think in terms of generations as opposed to in terms of quarters. And we have become a Wall Street that is fraught with doing ridiculous things in order to boost their earnings and boost their profits in the short term at the disadvantage of the long term. So the adage of short-term pain for long-term gain is something that Wall Street has been incredibly remiss to pay attention to. And it will bring about a reckoning that will be quite horrifically shocking. As our friend and colleague Brent Johnson from San Francisco says every now and again, it isn't a function of if, it's merely a function of when. And when it comes, it's going to be ugly, the economic calamity and the collapse. So in The Death of Money, James Rickert, which the book hasn't been released, but his interviews have indicated that he talks about the Americans losing their economic power and their economic dominance in the planet. Now, it also brings me back to some historic reviews, and I want to chat a little about how the aspect of looking back over 300 years and how the historical pattern has been for the turns of centuries to continue into the following century by 14 or 15 years. So let's you know, let's go back and do a wee bit of a review. So everyone knows that the 19th century, its uprightness, its optimism, its sense of purpose, the halcyon days of the British Empire, came to an end with World War I, starting in 1914 and building to a very nasty crescendo in 1916. So the 20th century had arrived, and it had some real horrors in store for us, okay? But if we go back another 100 years, we notice that the 18th century ends in about 1815 with the final defeat of Napoleon, the final project of the Enlightenment and of the French Revolution, okay? So now, with the Congress of Vienna in 1814-15, we have a new Europe along the line of Metternich's plan, and the 19th century at last is here, okay? Now we go back another 100 years, in 1713 and 14, we have the treaties of Utrecht, Baden, and Rastatt, bringing an end to the era of Spain as a major power, and the rise of the Habsburgs. Louis XIV dies in 1715 after reigning for 72 years. The Baroque period is over, and we are now firmly in the 18th century. So we still live in the 20th century. We still live in an era of Pax Americana. The old republic, very much a strained and tired empire now, with the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency. So the next task for us as historians and for history itself is to dismantle the untenable structures and institutions put in place by the late era, the era of the Americans, which has been extended now as far as it can go. We're now into 2014. We are now into a place where their financial nonsense has created a real mess. We are now so debt-laden that this monetary system of ours is going to collapse, and our paper currency, will be worthless. The debts are unmeetable, and the obligations thereon are going to just default. There are ironies and great contradictions as the former home and hope of liberty becomes viciously unfree and increasingly despotic. Our leaders no longer govern, but try instead to rule us. They are less legitimate with each passing day, and their laws corrupt or even worse. They are nearly finished and will be swept away with the tide. That phrase should not be lost on you now that we know the tide is rising. So just as in 1914, the internationalist system will break down, dashing the hopes of the would-be first world nations, and we will probably have a pretty good war as well, as many local ones are occurring worldwide. And these transitions generally have a tendency to involve war. That's a bit unfortunate, and it's a bit dire. However, it speaks of economic calamity, political calamity, and as I've said before, the explosion of greed. Now let's segue now into the thought or the concept of how and why wars might happen. Now we're looking at a Russian Crimea Ukrainian disconnect. It's really hard to understand exactly what is happening, and it behooves us to pay attention. Perhaps things are not as they seem. As we get further and further into the time of obscuration and making things very hard to figure out, this serves the powers that be to make sure nobody knows what they're really doing, because if their intent was truly transparent, many people would take great exception to their plans. Now, I'm not sure what's going on in Russia, but I have a pretty good grasp of the various perspectives, and I do know that there was a referendum that was put forward in the Crimea, and the Crimeans came out in great number, which is what we mentioned last week. They came out in great number to say, yes, we want to secede from the Ukraine. And the Ukraine is a country that is in the throes of going through its growing pains, just as Russia is going through it. There is great political and economic calamity in all of this. And in the throes of all this, perhaps somebody starts to throw weapons of mass destruction around. They start to throw bombs around. They start to throw bullets around. And we now become ensconced in another war. Well, 100 years ago, in 1914, a war started. What's to say that history doesn't repeat itself? Churchill coined it, and I'm sure perhaps it even came as far away as Plato, but you are destined to repeat that part of history which you are not aware of, you don't remember. Is a war going to happen? I don't know. Are we in a state of war right now in all kinds of places? Yeah, we talked about there are military exercises going on in 134 countries of the world. That's more than it has been it's more than it has been forever. So again, it brings us back to food for thought. The earth is changing. The water is coming. Water, by the way, esoterically is viewed as the emotional realm or the astral realm. Is the water of the melting of the icebergs, the water coming, the floods coming? Is it being overwhelmed with emotions? Well, I don't know. Are the newscasts and the mass media all designed to get you emotional? Are they designed to plug you into a place where you're excited or upset or afraid? I don't know. Speaks to me that may be the way. Do the governments rule you by saying, be afraid and we will protect you because you need to be afraid because somebody's going to come up and get you? I don't know. Sounds like a manner of that indeed. There is a war brewing. Is it inevitable? I do not know. The good news about everything is things are not inevitable if people wake up to what's going on. Now, will people wake up? I don't know. That is a hard one. That is a definitive query that we can put to ourselves. We propagate and like to share with our retooling listeners how the phrase, as go we, so go I, is incredibly important as we move through and into this new era, this coming age, where people are going to wake up. There's a reason it's called the time of revelation. It's because it calls people to wake up. And they have to wake up by their own volition and by their own hand. The governments are purposefully keeping you asleep in order so they can tell you to be afraid and listen to them so they can take care of you. It's time for self-reliance. And self-reliance is the only thing that will be contributory to the shift in this next stage. If you rely on the state, if you rely on other people who have different agendas that are different from yours, it may not result in the best result. So there we have it. We talk about the earth changes. We talk about the economic and political nonsense that is going on. And we also talk about the rumblings of war. Now, there's a great book that was written called War is a Racket, and it was written in the First World War, and it was written by a general who was an instrument of the war. And it's an important observation that those who are most ensconced in it take exception to it, and the powers that be don't want you to know about that. They don't want you to know that a war isn't good for you, okay? Okay, with that, ladies and gentlemen, I will bid you adieu. I've given you some food for thought. And on the other hand, in one of my teacher's words, the future, after all this subsides, the future in front of us is absolutely, brilliantly glorious. The transition period may be a bit unsettling, but the future is absolutely, brilliantly glorious. And so with that, I would like to bid you adieu. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to speaking with you next week.